Hello, everybody. Welcome to Binge Talking. This is my podcast where I get to talk to some of the interesting people I encounter living here in New York City. My next guest is the perfect embodiment of that. His name's John Joseph. He was one of the founders of the Cro-Mags. He's an Iron Man. He's a madman. This is sort of the perfect format to talk to John because there's nothing about his life that fits easily into sound bites. This is a long binge talk here. We go well over an hour. You won't hear much of me because most of the time my jaw is just on the floor and I'm lying in a fetal position, not even believing the words coming out of his mouth. So I initially reached out to John to take his rock and roll Lower East Side walking tour, which was something I had seen online for the past several years. Reached out, we linked up, we took the tour. It's part of my music special that airs the week of July 4th. It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe the amount of stories this guy had, the amount of knowledge I gained from taking the tour. You're going to get a glimpse of that. This is only a small portion of his whole thing, too. We get into his backstory, founding the Cro-Mags, going sober, the whole thing. I do have to put a warning, a very legit warning, about the subject matter we cover here, the language that's used. It's not my job to censor my guests in any way. I guess the only thing I can do is just alert you to the fact that you will be offended if you don't like strong language. But this is definitely one of my favorite episodes so far. So here he is, John Joseph. Author, Iron Man, musician, plant-based madman. After we did this too, he actually went and ran 10 miles in Central Park. I needed a nap just listening to him. Here's John Joseph.
From New York City, USA, welcome to the Fox 5 Podcast Network.
All right, Roland, where do I start with you, dude? Where would I ever start with you?
Conception.
Let's go a little after that. All right. So
there's a story in the conception.
I'm sure there's a story with everything with you. It's unbelievable. I went to do wearing a special when New York rocked. John's walking tour, which is amazing, is the second or third segment. Not sure which one yet, but we shot and shot and shot and shot. I thought our photographers were going to fall over. I thought I was going to fall over. Your stamina is unbelievable. You're an Iron Man. You do the whole thing. But so, John Joseph, people, how do people most know you at this point in your life? Because you're an outspoken, sort of famous vegan. You're an Iron Man. You're in the Cro-Mags. You're an author. Where do people come to you from at this point in your life?
Strangely enough, I'm getting more people hitting me up because of the plant-based recovery aspect.
Sure.
I'm in recovery, obviously, as are a lot of people that get into Iron Man and eating well and all that. I mean, you know, I've been doing the Cro-Mags since 1981 and punk rock. My other band was the Bad Brains Roadies in 81, Blood Clot. So, you know, that's been a long time thing. But more people hit me up now because of what's going on in the, you know. It's crazy with what's going on with the addiction.
Totally.
I mean, it's hit home with my own family, my brother and everything, so and even myself, so I just try to help.
Right, so I feel like, you know, in typical you fashion, you were super messed up for, like, not that long a period, but you went so far with it so fast, and you've been sober now forever, basically,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, since 1990 I had, my childhood was drug-fueled as well.
You grew up in the 70s when, which is people, that might be the GoPro, don't worry about that. But when you grew up, I feel like it was the height of people getting wasted from the age of like 10 onward. That was just a wild time.
I mean, I'm 56 now this year, so I started getting slammed at 13, 12 years old, smoking weed, then it was on to pills, angel dust, trafficked heroin.
It's crazy.
You know, I grew up in the foster care, abusive home. For 7 years, nearly, me and my two brothers, and you know, they shut the home down, and then bounced us around.
So the deal with that is basically the foster homes. It's a lot of the people, or the people in your situation, like, they're bad people who get the kids for the money, and then they don't share the money with the kids, right?
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, we were taken from my mom because my father was a professional boxer,
right? Yeah.
And he fought at actually Gramercy Gym with Customato. He trained there and fought at Sunnyside Gardens. He was a pretty big deal in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And was, I mean, like I said, the story starts before conception because my mother left him and he broke in and raped her. That's how I was born. So it's, you know, and he just beat the crap out of her and took her money, and he was just a thug.
Yeah.
And the state took us out of her home,
mm-hmm.
because she was a nervous wreck. She couldn't care for the kids.
Right, my
and,
God.
And, you know, she was on medication and stuff like that. So, you know, back then they put us in the Angel Guardian home in Long Island and then waiting for a foster family. So we got separated, and my brother, older brother, went into a foster home where bad shit was happening too,
yeah.
and they closed that house down. Like, the guy was only taking girls from the Vietnam era, and he was doing bad things
Jesus,
to them.
Jesus, right, wow.
So they closed that house down, and then he came in with me and my younger brother, and it was, you know, a house of horror in Long Island. And so then when they closed that, we went to, I went to St. John's Home for Boys in Rockaway Beach.
Yeah.
In 76, along with my older brother, E. Frank went to another foster home. And then we just went on to the streets from there. So
right,
it was
so
like
you,
my
yeah.
first acid trip in 76. You know, the dude tried to murder me.
What?
Yeah, he... I mean, St. John's had some crazy people in there. This guy was set on fire.
Oh, my God.
By his mother's boyfriend. And he was burnt from the neck, the chin down. He was just scar tissue. They threw him in a bathtub and threw lighter fluid on him because he woke up the mother's boyfriend. And he's was just a very unstable, very, very dangerous. I mean,
right.
the brothers told me he murdered two people. He's locked up for
life. Right, I mean, so that level of trauma, no one's going to come out of that unscathed.
Yeah, no, he was, I mean, he would just, you would see the lights go out in his eyes, mm-hmm. and then he would just, you know, they called it breaking. Like, he would just break on people
have
and try to kill
break.
Them.
Yeah.
So the first acid trip I ever did back then, he pulled out a knife and tried to murder me. And, you know, things went downhill in the boys' home after that. I mean, this is an era in New York that was insane.
Yeah.
I was seeing the Ramones at 116th Street, Rockaway Beach,
yep.
and going to Playland. And just, you know, and when I left St. John's, I was a heroin mule for junkie dealers that were out in Rockaway.
Because you were underage. So,
yeah, so, you know, and coming down to Alphabet City and learning the code of the streets. That your alphabet, A, B, C, D, means if you went to Avenue A, you were adventurous, B, you were bold, C, you were crazy, D, you were dead. Now it's
now
Avenue
you know
A,
your
Abercrombie and Finch, and P for Balducci's.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you get into all that on the walking tour in
and
such
my book.
Depth. In the book, and I mean, it's unbelievable. You're so prolific. You've got so much different avenues to express yourself. But right, the transformation that's happened there during your life is unbelievable. And when I went on the walking tour with you, I was joking with you after because I'm from a small town in Massachusetts. My wife grew up in Brooklyn. So she always rolls her eyes at how much I revere, you know, late 70s, early. I'm like, oh my God, Lower East Side is so great. And when I came back, she's like, so how did it go? And I go, I think I'm actually traumatized from hearing his stories. And I was dead serious. And she was so excited. She's like, thank God. Like, it wasn't as cool as you think it was. It was hardcore, violent stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think you're right.
Yeah. I mean, it took me getting locked up. I racked up three cases, two drug cases, and broke into a supermarket pharmacy type thing mm-hmm. and got caught on the roof. And then they just sent me upstate. So I did almost 2 years.
And your brother was already there.
My brother was already there. He... same deal.
Isn't that wild? It's like you went to college, but your brother was a junior in jail.
Yeah. When Mike Tyson talks about Spofford in the Bronx, let me tell you something. When I went to Spofford, I was in B3. I was the only white dude in the whole facility
mm-hmm.
and a target. Since the moment I walked into INDOC, this they had 20, 21 and under, and I was, what, 15? I turned 16 in Spofford, and this African-American dude that was like a grown-ass man was like, you're going to be my Maytag. And I was like, nah, you're going to be my Maytag. And everybody started laughing, and I said to the Spanish dude next to me, I'm like, yo, what the fuck is a Maytag? He's like, you just told that big brother over there he's going to be washing your drawers and sneakers.
Oh, my
God. So... needless to say, we got into it as soon as I got to the wing, and I the cops that took me to Spofford from Central Booking and Kew Gardens, because I got busted at the Dome in Forest Park for Angel Dust, selling Angel Dust, they were like, I'm going to tell you right now, McGowan, two Irish cops, they were like, the first people that fuck with you in Spofford, you better serve justice on them, because the last white boy ended up getting stabbed up.
And right, like, so all that prison stuff is true. Like, if someone steps to you, you gotta just go right at them.
If you, there's two ways to do it. You stand up for yourself, or you end up in PC, which back then was Punk City, protective custody.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't want that. So somebody did something that was not cool to me.
Yeah.
And when I was sitting in the TV lounge, can I say what it was?
Sure.
He pulled out his schlong and touched it to the back of my head, and I snapped on. I just picked up the chair and
I mean, the thing is too. I mean, the good news for you, if there is any, is that you are prepared for this. Like, this isn't like me going in soft as can be and like, oh, I've got a front on being tough. Like, you, that's your instinct, is to be like, you know.
Well, and on the streets, you know, I was like 130 pounds soaking wet, but the thing was, you know, like, you would always have an equalizer. In other words, like, I would pick something up and put it across. If you mess with me, that's how it had to be, because the maniacs that I was rolling with on the streets were, I mean, two of them ended up getting murdered. The other one friggin' is in jail for murder. The other ones are dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, I was rolling with grown men that were like, yo, you know, teaching you the ways of the streets.
Right.
And it was like, you know, and that's what I would say. Oh, you're 6'2", 195 pounds. This baseball bat makes me your size.
Yeah, right.
So that's, you know, and in lockup, you know, they talk about you got to get your weight up. And that's what it was, because, you know, I barely ate on the streets. I went in to lock up 130 something pounds, soaking wet. I came out 165.
How do you even bulk up on like that?
Three squares, three hots in a cot. You're eating,
eating.
And they had an athletic program upstate, and so I was working out with weights and boxing, and they had a football program. So it was kind of, you know, it was a lock up, but it was, you know, it was kind of like, keep you active.
Yeah.
So you don't get in trouble type deal.
Right.
But there was everybody from attempted murder on down where I was.
That's
like,
wild.
You know,
I mean,
it's
like
the
whole system, it's not about rehabilitation at all. I mean, it's
gonna
make
it's
more
warehousing,
insane.
Man.
Yeah.
It's even gotten worse now. It's just warehousing. Like, Spofford doesn't even exist anymore, because I go and speak at a lot of these places now. I've been to like the different lockups all over the city. I went to Goshen, Maximum Security, like, they give it different names now. But what they did with Spofford, they broke it up to like mini Spoffords all over the city, these lockup facilities, and you would walk by it, and you know, unless you read the fine print on the door, you wouldn't even know what the fuck it was.
Yeah.
But you know, I make it my thing to pay it forward, to help kids. I speak at high schools and everything, you know. So
that's interesting. You do. All right, you get out of that system, then you wind up on the streets in the Lower East Side, which was completely out of control back in the day.
Well, I didn't go back to the Lower East Side. When I got locked up, when I got out, they had to release me to an adult.
Oh,
so they
okay.
released me to my mother.
Yeah.
But we never lived together, basically, since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
So that didn't go well. And, you know, the thing was, you know, Lincoln.
Did she have a new husband or anything like
that?
Nah,
she had a boyfriend and didn't really want us around.
Can you imagine being her boyfriend and you show up?
Well, you know, the boyfriend that she had was the reason we were left to get some of the worst abuse possible in this foster home, because she kept saying she was going to take us, but he didn't want us around.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
So, you know, they call that cock blocking. Like, yeah. So there's three kids coming home. So he was kind of a prick to us.
I can't imagine the hatred you must have for that person.
You know what? I had to forgive him as part of the process because I wrote about it in my book, The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon. Mm. He actually passed from cancer. And you know, it's a whole crazy story because when I started doing well, like my mother's husband robbed her blind and was a gambler, alcoholic dude, and sold the house. So when she divorced him, she had nothing.
Jesus.
She was homeless, so I had record deals and everything.
Yeah.
And I got her an apartment, furniture, TV. And then she calls me one day. She's like, I have something to tell you. And she's like, you know, Carl's living with me. And I was like, the dude that didn't want me around
is now living in the,
the apartment that I paid for. And I fucking lost it on her. I was like, you know, me and her had it out on the phone. And then she was like, I never planned. That's when I found out, you know, she told me the whole, geez, her story.
Whoa.
And we just sat there, and I swear to God, we sat there. It had to be 10 minutes of not saying a word, sobbing on the phone to each other. Like, just, you know, I never knew she was raped, and she left him, only planned to have my brother. He raped her. That's how I was born, and then my younger brother. He broke in it, but they were still married, so the cops were like, how could your husband rape you?
Oh, right, it was back in those
it's
days.
It's back in them days, and he's like this Irish hooligan dude.
Yeah.
So I never knew her story or had... since my book has come out, me and her are so tight now.
Oh, good.
And I just wanted her to be happy, and I actually helped him transition because he apologized. He sat on my stoop, and this was a big fucking dude. I mean, he beat my father down.
Who was the boxer, right?
Yeah, he beat my father down because my father was still beating up my mom, and this dude stepped in, and he was like a big blue-collar Con Ed worker, just fucking hammered him.
Yeah.
And he never bothered my mother again, but when he was passing with cancer, he was down to like maybe 130, 140 pounds, sick, sitting on my stoop and crying and apologized.
Wild.
You know, he wouldn't say, you know, he just said, I'm sorry. Like, and we made amends, and that's what life is about, is you have to forgive people, and you know, and I did. But so when I got out of lockup, I went home, and I mean, they had us in the Scared Straight program, the original program in the 70s. So we went to Rawway, we went to Fishkill. But the thing is, you could be scared for a couple of weeks, but you get released to the same thing without any skill set.
Yeah.
And I went right back to selling drugs and caught another case.
Mm-hmm.
So it was between, my mom knew this Navy recruiter at the time or was dating. I don't know what the situation was, but he was able to get my record done away with and get me in the Navy.
Oh, yeah. Right,
so
right.
I went into the buddy program. Into the buddy program in the Navy with my brother.
So then you do that. You're in the Navy. You get to Jamaica. We sort of... Then you wind up meeting up with the Bad Brains in New York, right?
No.
In D.C. They're from
Norfolk, Virginia.
Virginia, which
is
D.C.
Yeah. I was the only punk rocker on the entire naval base in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah.
Because I was into punk rock. I left that out in the 70s. I was going to Max's.
Because, I mean, you saw it at the very beginning of its existence.
Yeah.
Like, people who weren't from New York wouldn't even know it existed.
I mean, the first time I went to Max's, and I talk about it on the walking tour, I got the shit beat out of me. Because the dude I went to Max's Kansas City with decides we took 14th Street Park. You know, 14th Street, for those of you that don't know, in Union Square, was nothing but porno theaters and the Palladium
and
Julian's
Billiards. And it wasn't called Union Square back then,
And we called it 14th Street Park, and it was the Walmart of the drug world. You could buy any drug in there, prostitution. So we bought, like, Two-N-Alls and got smashed. And
Downers or something?
Yeah,
what is that?
It's like, and these Placidils, we split one of those, and those are, like, horse tranquilizers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm this little kid. I passed out. Kind of like nodding out.
Yeah.
And then he was getting
Max's,
shit beat out of him. And then goes, you know, John, help. And then they were like, oh, you're with this motherfucker? And then guess what? I got the shit beat out of me. My God. The first time I went to Max's, and you know,
this is not like hanging out with Jagger and Bowie.
No, this was this is
the opposite of Max.
And what I say, like the punk rock shit that I got, you know, when the Ramones sang, we taught the brat with a baseball bat. That's real, like punk. The punk rock that I was exposed to ain't the punk rock that you see in Hot Topic now and all this crap. The punk rock I got exposed to was, I will break this bottle and stab you in your jugular throat 30 times if you fuck with me.
Right.
That's punk rock from Max's and CB's and all the clubs in the early days. Even the Mud Club came later. But
yeah,
like,
that was fancier, right? I mean, wasn't the Mud Club was more like,
well, it was on White Street. Nah, it wasn't. No. It was a shithole. You know, everyone glorifies the shit. That place fucking, you know, I started going there in 1980.
The only thing I know about Mud Club is I see that picture of the Emotional Rescue album release party where like mixing like these funky little glasses.
Yeah, I mean there was bands that played there. Henry Rollins played his first show with Black Flag there. Mm. I was at that, and you know. But anyway, the thing was, I should have never really been allowed in the Navy because like I had psychological, you know, issues going on. I was violent as hell, still taking drugs. You know, I violated a lot of things that I shouldn't have in the military. Yeah. I smuggled drugs. I sold drugs in Norfolk. I was just like, I was the only punk rocker from the Navy that the Norfolk punk rockers let hang out.
Okay.
Because like they didn't like military people, but I was a fighter and these rednecks was messing with everybody and I beat the crap out of two of them. And then they were like, oh, okay, you can hang out. I said, I didn't need your motherfucking permission. I was hanging out anyway. But you guys are chumps.
Right. So you wind up, and then you get down.
I met the Bad Brains
down there
in Norfolk.
And then I was reading because like then what they get basically banned because they were black punk bands. So the clubs like F this, we're not letting them play. And
they got
up here,
banned
right?
Because their manager wanted them to become a pop band. Oh. If you hear their first single, it was Pay to Come on one side, and it shows the dichotomy of their music. And then Stay Close to Me was like a pop hit. If that came out today, it would be on commercial radio. So their kind of manager wanted them to go pop. They're the most accomplished musicians I've ever. I saw Led Zeppelin in the 70s. Right. I saw Sabbath, yes, The Who, The Stones, you name it. Mm-hmm. When the Bad Brains played, and the first time I saw them, it just floored me.
Yeah.
And I was like, I have to meet these people.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to do what the manager said, and he was a very influential dude in DC. That's why they didn't sell out. That's why they were banned from DC.
Oh, I
not because they were black. Okay. Then it became because they were black punk rockers.
Yeah.
But the reason was their manager had them banned. He was a very influential.
I got you. Oh, interesting. All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a level of nuance they don't have on like online and stuff about
that. Yeah, it's the, you know, so it was kind of like, you know, play pop music or you ain't going to play music kind of thing.
Boy, that's crazy to even imagine them doing pop music because you mentioned you're always on the walking tour, like, find the CBGB's 1982 on YouTube. That's the most hardcore thing I've ever seen in my life.
It's insane. And then there's 79 Christmas and they came up and played CBGB's. And you watch that video, and it's like HR's he's wearing a suit, like just going off.
Yeah.
See, I met them when they first, they didn't even have dreadlocks yet. Yeah. I met them right after that. I met them, I think it was April of 1980.
And it's fascinating. So, like, they were into the whole, you talk about a little bit, like, Babylon Foods, which is what, meat and rich, like, sort of
they
European
have a
diet or
yeah,
whatever?
Yeah, well, you know, meat, fit, like, the Rastafarians eat an Ital diet, which is they don't even use oil. Everything is whole food, plant-based, a lot of raw food. So they were doing it before anybody.
Right.
So they have a saying, Ital is vital, Lotal is fatal. Mm-hmm. So the first time I went to Jamaica on my ship, you know, I tell this story in a book too. They, you know, wherever you pulled in on the port, they would sit all the enlisted down in the mess deck and show you videos. Okay, here's what to watch out for when you pull in this port, and use condoms if you get with any of these prostitutes. And under no circumstances should you talk to these people. And it was like Rastas with you know, ganja smoke coming out of every fucking nostril and their ears and eyeballs. And I'm like, that's the first people I went to look for when I got off the ship.
Now, what's the reaction to you when you come strolling into the neighborhood and they see you coming?
Well, you know what? When the ships pull in, they all wait there to hustle. Because, dudes were telling me, yo, back then you could trade a radio, boxes of soap, all kinds of shit you could trade for weed. It was like, it was bugged out. So we pulled into Mo Bay. There was none of the hotels or any of that shit you see now. And then, I would always get away from everybody else on my ship because I didn't really fit in with them. I was always looking for my tribe. I didn't have a family.
Yeah.
You know, then I ran with, you know, foster homes and finding out you think these people love you. And then it's like you find out that they're fucking just doing it for the money and they're beating the shit out of you and every other fucking thing and starving you and just real animalistic fucking people that you know, whatever happens to them, they deserve it.
Have you done formal therapy or did you just all work this out in your own?
You know, my therapy is to do Iron Man and I chant Hare Krishna and I do yoga and to me that's the music. The music's been my therapy since, and I wrote about that in my book too. I said it's always been music, even when my father was breaking in the house and beating the shit out of my mother. It was, you know, in the kitchen with the Motown 45s on a record player dancing around with her. The foster home, I had a little AM radio that I, you know, these people were sexually abusing us, everything. And the other kids, the older kids that were there, and that was my escape, you know, was to you know, listen to, you know, all the music on the AM radio.
Right.
And then, like, you know, on the streets, it was the punk rock. I had an outlet. I remember hearing Iggy Pop in, like, 75 and Bowie and all that and being in Garden City with all the yuppies in this foster home. That was the first foster home we went into after the other one. And they were, like, they had the same last name as me and, like, freaking, we said they were our cousins and we were just damaged goods at that point, but they took all three of us, and we only lasted like 4 months there. We just did so much crazy shit that they kicked us out. They were like, you know, return to sender kind of deal. Take these motherfuckers out of here. Because it was all yuppies in Gardens. Actually, my brother E went to school with Arthur McCanty Jr. Arthur McCanty was the famous referee for all the Ali fights and all that.
Oh, wow, okay.
He went to school with Garden City High School with Arthur McCanty Jr. It was in his classes. So it was like, you know, it was always music that helped me get through everything. Being locked up, it was the same thing, music. And what's funny is when you're locked up, you know, you say the whites stay with the what. You know, that's just, you know, that's just the way it ended up being because you have to think about something. I got locked up when Roots came out and the 5%ers just started coming in prison. And no matter how I wanted to hang out and listen to black music or hang
you
with...
You couldn't do that.
No, because they were listing me as a white devil. They called me Yaku and all this shit.
Oh,
and like,
wow.
The racial tensions in the lockups was heavy back then.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got all these brothers watching Roots and then you're like sitting back there and they're like, Kunta Kinte, motherfucker. Like, you know, it was ill, dude. It was like, you know, and retaliation. Mm-hmm. There was fights like crazy.
Right.
And I just got along with everybody. But then, you know, the heads they called us was, you know, we were smuggling drugs into the facility. We were getting weed and whatever the fuck. So it was like, you know, we hung out and listened to 8-tracks. And I think cassettes just had come back then and we were listening to Zeppelin and all the stoner music, but when I would hear, you know, P-Funk and all the rest of the stuff, I was like, yo, you know, I like that music too. Like, I grew up on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it was always music. And then I got to actually, when I left, you know, because I got in trouble in Norfolk. I sold drugs to an undercover at the King's Head Inn, which was a punk club. And I got caught, and then that case was pending, and then this redneck on my ship kept fucking with me, and the entire time in my command I was on the USS Arkansas, and I was like, yo, dude, you need to back the fuck off. And things just started getting worse and worse with my...
Because that's a fight you're going to lose, right? Basically, if he's in command or like... I mean,
well, he wasn't... He was with the command. Mm-hmm. I'm saying he was a boatswain mate like me a decade. Mm-hmm. So, like, he just said some shit to me, and I was restricted to the ship already. And...
So they wouldn't let you off when you
get
the
places like we
in.
Would pull into port. We just left, you know, we went to, I don't know, the Caribbean stuff, Bermuda, yeah. Puerto Rico and all that, and left Puerto Rico, and I couldn't leave the ship. I was restricted. And I was working, and they took all, they busted me down to E1 pay grade, took all my money. Mm-hmm. So I was working for free.
Jesus.
And he said some shit to me on the wrong day, and I just like locked him in the paint locker and beat him with a fucking paint can. Bad.
Yeah.
Hospitalized. And then they, you know, put me on lockdown. And you know, it's like weird the whole way everything goes down because I had gotten some wisdom teeth extracted before I in Puerto Rico. So I got this super bad infection that, like, they were like, this dude's going to die if we don't get him to a hospital. So they medevaced me off the ship. There was a helo on a CGN-41. There was a helo
helicopter
on the flight deck in the back. So they airlifted me off the ship to the hospital in Puerto Rico and forgot to say that I was supposed to be a prisoner and cut me papers and fucking check.
Oh,
and I just started partying in Puerto Rico. And then... After I got out of the hospital. I was on a, you know, medication and everything. Yeah. And then
I hope you didn't mix alcohol with that. Alcohol.
Nah,
it
was
no good.
But and then they said, well, your command went down past the equator for shellback, you know, past Brazil. So we're gonna fly you back to Norfolk. So they put me in TPU, transient personnel unit, Nimitz Hall, and forgot to say again that I was supposed to be restricted.
Yeah.
So I was going,
I feel like bad record keeping back in the day, like, made things easier, right? To slip through the cracks.
Oh,
like, now
hell
with computers,
yeah.
It's like,
nowadays,
it would never happen
now. Forget it. You're never getting away with that.
Right.
So then, like, I made friends with the dude there, and basically they got the call that the ship's coming in. This guy's supposed to be a prisoner. Like, put him on lockdown. There's a lockdown unit in the wing in Nimitz Hall. You know, so as I'm going out, the dude at the front desk goes, your ship's coming in today. Like, wink, wink. Gave me the heads up.
Yeah.
And I just ran upstairs, packed the bag, and I walked out of that base with $20 in my pocket and not knowing where the hell I was going in life.
Jeez.
Hitchhiked to D.C., hung out with Ian MacKay, Henry Rollins, let me stay at their house.
Yeah.
For like, I don't know, it was like a week. I ate all their food. They threw me out.
What do you do? Do you show up and be like, I love punk music?
No, they knew me from the scene. I was already like going up to D.C. on the weekends in 1980, and they liked me because... The thing was, all the rednecks that hung out in D.C. and the Marines and shit would beat up the punk rockers, and I was a brawler, so we would just throwing down on anybody that fucked with us, and they you know, and Henry and those guys, man, Henry Rollins is a fucking bad motherfucker,
right,
like he is a fucking bad dude. I remember watching him, Creepy Crawl was the dance, and he would just move in slow motion and like, you know, just jacked and be like, I want to be like that motherfucker.
Right.
The first time I saw him, it was the Teen Idols and the Untouchables came down, and then I was, you know, that was before the Bad Brains, and then going up to D.C. and seeing him and hanging out with all those cats.
Yeah.
And I was like, yo, this is my crew. This is my family. This is my tribe. This is where I belong. Where I never belonged anywhere in life. I was always like this nomadic fucking, where the fuck do I fit in?
Right.
So you have to understand the psychological shit I was going through. I never got help mixed with the drugs and everything else. Like the military said, I was a time bomb waiting to go off. They had me seeing shrinks.
Right.
And
I'm surprised you don't embrace therapy. That's like the only thing.
Nah, I didn't. You know, my therapy was... challenging myself. And I'm going to tell you right now, my therapy was writing that book, because when I wrote The Evolution of a Cro-Magnon, I spent 5 years as a monk. I didn't date anybody. There was times I would write that book where I would get to the part about what happened to us in that foster home, and I would just break down and crying and couldn't even.
Yeah.
And I kept going over that part because it was embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm supposed to be whatever, you know. That's the problem with shit that happens to people and they hold it in. Who knows what happens to these people that,
commit suicide
and get drug addicted. If you look, it was something in the past that they're not facing and dealing with.
Yeah.
And who knows if that would have been my path or whatever, but I chose to deal with it by writing. That was my therapy.
Yep.
And I would get to that part and just stop and be like, literally lose my shit at my desk for like an hour and just fucking be like, I would just stop writing.
Yeah.
And then I was writing a screenplay, and so we went to do the Robert McKee seminar, Story. He wrote the book Story, and I was really struggling with what, because we were using what happened with my childhood for one of the characters. We were basing his childhood off of that. So I went up to Robert McKee. In between breaks, he would go out to smoke cigarettes, but you could ask him questions. And I kind of was giving him like this green tea extract for his cough. He smoked it. So we kind of had a little, you know, Irish thing going between me and him. And I was like, can I ask you a question in terms of, you know, the unconscious desires and stuff like that. Like, he has all the terminology to, that motivates a character to do certain things. You know, a character that was abused as a child, and he was like, he stops me and he goes, child abuse is the number one fucking cliche used today to gain any kind of sympathy and empathy for a character that we could otherwise give two shits about. They're writing flat, hollow characters, and they throw this in there so we give a fuck. And he goes, it's not about what happened. It's what the character does as a result of it. And that was the fucking, you know, I still get goosebumps, you know, because that was the moment when I was like, this is what I got to do.
Yeah.
And then I was able to write it. And when that book came out, it shocked a lot of fucking people. I have a lot of famous
people didn't think it was real, right? Right.
Well, I had a lot of famous people writing me and being like, "Yo, that shit happened to me too," and then a lot of people thought that the shit can't be true. The dude from the Village Voice, like, I got the cover of the Village Voice, but he tried to debunk it because it came out the same time as A Million Little Pieces. This dude talking about getting locked up and
Anthony
fucking,
Fry or whatever, yeah.
You know, went on Oprah and all this shit, and his book was bullshit.
Yeah, yeah.
So he tried to say, like, fucking, you know, come on, man, get the fuck out of here. Like, when I met with him, he wanted to do a piece on the book. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, there's no fucking way that you did everything in that book.
Right.
Like, come on, man. You fucking.
I mean, it's a logical takeaway because your life is so dense, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, but then, you know what I had to do? I said, listen, I'll give you my mother's number, whoever the fuck you want to talk to. They'll verify everything in the book. And he goes, really? And I said, absolutely. And I gave it to him. And, you know, my mother didn't even know I was writing the book, wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, because we did it independently. It didn't come out with a publisher. We did 10,000 copies on our own.
Oh, no kidding.
So she fucking verified everything. She's like, everything, you know, he was like, did this happen? Did you know, with your husband and the foster homes and the lockups and the angel dust and the Navy and blah, 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 blah. And just, and then I gave him the other references for the shit on the streets that I did. And he was like, couldn't fucking believe it. And they gave me the cover of the Village Voice when that book came out.
Right.
And I mean, I got endorsements. Patty Jenkins, who did Monster, and she just did Wonder Woman, said like,
You know all sorts of talented people from that world.
Yeah,
down there,
like,
right?
I mean, I grew up, you know, and she's like a legit badass herself. Mm-hmm, she's fucking got street cred. She put a beer mug in this dude's face that used to fuck with everybody. You know, this big dude with dreads, and he was a bully.
At CBGB, right?
No, this was at the Alcatraz, at King Tut's Wawa Hut, which was A7.
Oh, okay. So yeah.
This guy used to fuck and was like smack.
Was A7 what Niagara is now?
Yeah.
Okay.
A7, okay. Like, yeah, A7 opened in 80.
That was part of our thing we did.
Yeah. But like, you know, so a lot of people, you know, the main thing about the book is it's helped other people. And I say that was my intention was, you know, hey, man, this is my journey. A lot of people have been through, you know, similar things. You know, some of the people that I've talked to, even worse things than what I've been through.
Right.
But it's brought my family closer together. A lot of people have reached out to me and been like, yo, man, this book fucking, if you fought through this shit, I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's in its second release now. We just did, you know, it's sold upwards of 20,000 copies now without even a fucking publisher. We just like, it's just been this underground. I did the audio book. But it was designed, that was my therapy.
Right.
You know, every day.
You did work through
and,
it.
And,
right.
and
yeah.
you know, I stayed sober when I wrote it. I was training in martial arts. I was training for Ironman. I was, not even Ironman, just triathlon. I knew I wanted to do a triathlon. That didn't even come up yet because it came out in 2007. But I stayed out of relationships. Like when I wrote the book, everything. I just stayed to myself. And was basically a celibate monk all them years, and really that's what got me through it all, and a lot of spirituality, chanting, meditation, and service to others.
Yeah,
feeding the homeless, always trying to help other people because people help me,
mm-hmm.
and that's my thing in life is to pay that forward. Now, if nobody reached out and pulled me out of the hell I was in, and I talk about that, I just finished my third book. About PMA, positive mental right. attitude.
Which is so crazy because my first grade teacher, when we would leave every day, she'd make us say PMA.
See that?
Mrs. Broy, that's so weird. That's so weird.
You know,
that
comes
like,
from Napoleon Hill, his books and stuff. And he was the first PMA. Like self-help dude.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where HR got it from. They wrote a song, Attitude. Don't care what they may say, we got that attitude. Don't care what they may do, we got that attitude. Yeah, we got that PMA. Yeah, we got that PMA. And I was like, this fucking dude's doing backflips and fucking dreadlocks flying and fucking diving off the top of the PA. I'm like, what the fuck is PMA? He's like, you know, positive mental attitude, man. And I was like, fuck yeah, man. That's
right.
What it's about. And it's been a struggle. Like, you know, after everything, some shit happened in the Cro-Mags and dudes in the band burned me in 87, and I slipped into addiction for 2 years.
Mm.
88 to 90 was, I started out freebasing with, I told you the whole story.
Oh, that's
very
when that
wealthy,
story happened? Yeah.
Very wealthy, you know. Actually, I started smoking, this guy in that building, I lived at 700 East 9th, where Daniel Rakowitz, the East Village butcher, chopped up his girlfriend and fed her to the homeless, made soup out of her. And it was just a really fucking dark period in my life I was, you know, I had nothing. I worked for all those years with the Cro-Mags, and then I just couldn't go on because the dude in the band who was my best friend just ripped me off.
Right.
Like I was a piece of shit.
Like you work
shit.
All that way and then it gets taken.
And I was like, everything was gone. And I came home and you know, because he took all the tour money and I was homeless. And Christmas time is always a very difficult time because we were left in the foster home on Christmases, or then we would get to visit my mom and we would just not want to go back. There's a picture in the book of us when Christmas time in my face, I'm like so pissed off as a kid because we had to go back to the foster home. So to be coming off tour and then be homeless because of that. And then I just started, you know, staying with this dude. And I was also seeing this girl who was in LA at the time, very wealthy, and was sending us like all this cocaine. So I started doing coke and fell into that freebasing, and then it got into crack, and then I had to get out of New York because I was robbing
right?
a lot of dealers, and they put like a TOS, KOS, whatever, terminate on site, kill on site, kind of like shoot this motherfucker when we see him.
Yeah.
and some shit went wrong with a robbery we did, and you know, I had some very bad dudes looking for me, and I went to LA, and then all, you know, started out in a mansion on Pacific Coast Highway with this girl, and by the end of it, you know, we were in a freaking crack motel in Compton. She was getting ready to, you know, turn tricks to, you know, I was like, that was the next phase, but we burned everything, and her parents were loaded, which I won't mention names and stuff like that, but
they were just super wealthy. Out of that. Right.
Yeah, we, her stepfather did the Ronald Reagan inaugural ceremony, so I mean, that's who we were dealing with, big movie, TV producer type people.
Yeah. And
friends with FBI people, they put them on our tail. Like the shit that we did out there.
My life is so friggin' boring.
Insane.
I love it.
And it was like, I honestly was like, it was kind of like this unconscious suicide mission.
Mm. Like, you had nothing to live for anymore.
Yeah, yeah. I just was like, yo, I didn't give a fuck. And everybody that, nobody would stay around me because they were like, this dude's like, you know. And, you know, things, we did a lot of messed up things in L.A. And it's funny because, like, you know, I told a story about, like, I had first of all, we had warrants on us. Then I had federal warrants because of leaving the military. I got no license. And, like, we're trying to sell the car. And we tried to sell it to a dealer in L.A. who called... called the name on the
title,
on the title, right. And the mother was, you know, I heard him saying in the back, you know, I'll stall and keep him till you get here with the police. And I just punched him in the face, took the title. We ran out as soon as we got out of there and pulled away. Fucking cops rolled up with her mother. And just,
you would never get away with this stuff because of cameras now, right? I mean, I feel like this is all,
you
like...
you never get away with it now.
Yeah.
And then, like, we were like, what the fuck are we going to do? And then she was like, oh, I know this car dealer in Palm Springs. Like, I grew up with him. So I'm like, bet, let's go. Because we had to dump the car. We're trying to get out of L.A. We had everybody looking for us. We had, like, gangs in L.A. because I robbed some people out,
right,
there,
yeah,
too. I won't say, you know, who it was, but... so we had to get the fuck out of there, and you know, so I'm driving.
Talking with you is like when I watch Sopranos and then it's over and I go, wow, my life is so chill. Oh my God, what am I worried about anything?
You know, it's like, I could understand why the dude would think that I made this shit up in the book.
Right.
You know, the funny shit was I'm driving fucking 100 miles an hour through the desert. I'm driving. Got no license. Everybody's after us, which we didn't know the extent of yet. And I get pulled over. And I'm like, Kate, didn't want to say anything. That's not her real name anyway. I said, it's over. That's it. I'm going to prison right now. So this like state trooper comes up. And this was in the 80s. He must have been like 40. And he puts, you know, with the whole hat and everything, you know, the glasses,
right,
like cliche to the max. He's like, license and registration. And I'm just standing there, you know, in the driver's seat. And through my mind, I'm like, should I fucking pull him through this window? Like crazy shit. Like, you know, your whole
shit. You've got no good options.
Because I'm
point,
like,
yeah,
no good options. And I'm like, I'm going to prison right now. Like, that's what you're faced with if I don't yoke this dude up. And then I'm like, no, but he kept one arm on the fucking thing, and then one arm was on his revolver in case, because I didn't respond to him when he said license and registration. I was just like this, like blank, like, but thinking.
Yeah.
And then he goes, sir, I'm not going to ask you again, license and registration. He's unsnapped the catch on his holster at this point, and he's got one arm on the fucking on the windowsill, and like, you know, you see him looking in, and then he's got a tattoo on his arm, and I'll never forget it. And he had the boatswain mate insignia with DD, whatever his hull number was on his ship, which meant destroyer, and then he had Shellback. So I said, hey, Boats, when did you cross the equator on that tin can? And he's like, you were Navy boy? And I'm like, fuck yeah, I was a boatswain. I said, we beat the shit out of them polywogs. I was on a CGN and mug and blah, 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 blah. You know, I fucking hated going over the side in the boatswain ladder out at sea. And he fucking was shooting his shit. And then he's like, oh, fuck, man, I can't give no Navy man a ticket. He's Dude. Like, listen. Just keep it under 70 out here because, like, the next guy is not going to be so nice. And we were like, and he fucking walked away. And we just fucking, had he run that plate. So we get to the deal.
How have you not had 45 heart attacks in your life?
Plant-based diet. So we, listen, even yeah. through all my addiction, I never ate meat, dairy, none of that shit. I would wake up. After 3 days of smoking crack and be like, yo, let's get wheatgrass. Like, and this other dude was telling, you know, was doing this shit too. And, you know, my brother always says, like, motherfucker, you don't need wheatgrass. You need a fucking straitjacket. Like,
right, right.
But I stayed on the diet. I would detox with juice after fucking three-day yeah. binge of freebasing and crack and then pills to come down and fucking alcohol. And, like, so then we get to the dealer. We give the dude the title, and he runs the VIN number, and he comes out, and his fucking face is just like ghost white. He's like, you two better get the hell out of here. He's like, there's a warrant for you that you kidnapped her, and she's wanted for fraud and all, and this vehicle's reported stolen. And when I ran the VIN number, an alarm came off from the police department to hold us there. So they had reported the car stolen that I kidnapped her and, you know, reported her for fraud or writing all the bad checks and maxing out
fronting
credit.
The whole lifestyle.
Just, we spent, you know, all told with selling the car probably like maybe close to a couple hundred grand. I mean, 200. Yeah. Probably, who the fuck knows, man? We were
30 years ago of her parents' money.
Yeah, we were buying, like, if somebody wanted a stereo, okay, here, give us a fucking half ounce of blow. Like, here's your stereo. Right. Whatever it was with the credit cards. So they turned, we just maxed all, like, and I mean, she had platinum credit lines, whatever the fuck. Then it was the bad checks. We did all that. Then we started... You know,
which
selling
you get
jewelry
away with either,
and all that shit, everything. Mm. When you total everything that we got rid of in it, so I'm driving back to L.A. and I'm like, what the fuck are we gonna do now? And actually, she was driving at that point because I was like, you know. And then she's like, look, I know this coke dealer, and he'll work something out. So we went to meet this dude. I think he was down at Venice Beach at the time, and he gave us 2 ounces of blow. $1,000 and 2 plane tickets for her car. So then, you know, meanwhile, all her friends are trying to catch her. But
right.
I was hiding out at underground punk rock houses, so I was off the grid. Nobody, that's why they couldn't find me and her. And I told her, never contact anybody in your family, nothing.
Right, right.
So, but she saw sides of me that was like, this dude is going to kill somebody or get killed because I had to light up on motherfuckers sometimes and just beat people down. Because when you're in that world of crack and freebase and you're a white dude and it's like motherfuckers think that they're going to take advantage of you and it's like, no, you're not. Shit happens.
How psyched are you to not be in that world anymore?
Very psyched. As a matter of fact, I'm going on tour in Europe this weekend and then I come back and... working on the new book and then, you know, training for Ironman Florida and helping people. And I got a YouTube channel and, you know, it's a load off your mind, you know. But so we get the plane tickets. We got rid of the car. So we're on the plane. And back then, this is how crazy it was. They never searched your bag when you got on the plane. I didn't have ID. I got on the plane. I fucking got on the plane. I checked an ounce in the check-in luggage underneath the plane, and I had an ounce in the backpack. Meanwhile, I'm like, we're going to sell this coke and go straight and have jobs and, you know. Yeah, okay.
Fast forward 3 hours.
We're on the plane, and I'm like, basically, I was like, you know, I'm so glad we made it out of that. We're going to change our lives. And, like, I just started noticing, like, she was becoming frightful of being around me. And you know, with respect to that person, yeah, I was definitely not somebody that you should be around because it was bad. And but I also saw that she wanted it to be over. Like, she started, like, one time, I remember this one scene, we were in a freaking Compton motel, and I smoked all my shit, I freebased it, and she had, like, a quarter ounce under her pillow, because she would hide it, and I was jonesing so bad, and I went to, you know, go under her pillow and take her coke, and she woke up and just started punching me in the face, and I just fell onto the carpet crying. I was like, I need it.
Oh my God.
She's like, you're fucking pathetic. You're fucking pathetic. Look at you. I don't know why I ever fucking got involved with you. It was like, even in the dealership, we had this drug addict argument.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm writing about this. I'm adapting this section for a film and stuff. And it's just,
your girlfriend to be played by Courtney Love.
Yeah, it was so. That's not even acting. fucking, she could just. There's no method right. acting involved there. But you know, I could tell she wanted to be done with me. And
yeah.
And this was the real turning point of how I remained sober since then. And so we get on the plane, and then, like, you know, I started noticing she was acting weird, and I'm like, yo, you know, you didn't tell nobody that we're on this plane. And she didn't answer me at first. I said, yo, Kate, you didn't tell anybody that we're on this fucking flight. And she's like, not really. I was like, what do you mean, not really? She's like, well, I mentioned to Nadine that everything's going to be all right. We're flying back to New York.
Right.
And I was like, are you out of your fucking mind? Like,
now you realize you're in a plane and you're caught, basically.
Nadine,
right?
Well, was the daughter of Post Cereal. They lived next door to her in Santa Monica on Pacific Coast Highway. Like, she hated me. So she fucking, I was like, what the fuck? They're going to be waiting for us at JFK. You fucking, I can't believe it. You fucking threw me under the bus. I'm going to fucking federal prison. Now, you think we're going to have this tender moment where I'm like, I love you, baby. Nope. The next words out of my mouth when I turned and looked at her, we got to sniff all the coke in the overhead. I swear to God, I started running to the bathroom and with this ounce of coke and just sniffing boulder-sized lines. I was frothing from the mouth. I'm walking up and down the aisles. People are eating their dinner, and I'm like, you're all going to fucking hell for eating animals. Fucking, if this plane crashes, you're going to come back as a cow and be like, just insanity.
God,
like, quoting
dude.
Bhagavad Gita.
Dude.
Like, like out of my mind.
Dude.
I sniffed over a quarter ounce of that fucking blow. And the stewardesses are like, sir, take your seat. We're not going to tell you again. Like, and then when we landed, I said, you're going to walk ahead of me through the tunnel, you know, that connects, the chute that connects to the terminal. And it was pissing rain in. I just remember the whole shit so vividly. And I said, you're giving me a chance to get away. Mm-hmm. I have one chance to get away, and I'm taking it. So I put on a baseball cap, and like, and then she walked ahead of me. So when she got out, I merged in with this family, and
I mean, that they would have brought that plane down in Phoenix or whatever nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean,
that
would not even made it
anywhere
in New York.
Yeah. They would have fucking they would have fucking landed that plane and taken
eight of the guys would have jumped you and sat on you.
Oh,
too.
Hell
you got,
yeah.
I mean, like,
because, well, after 9/11, the whole game changed.
Yeah.
You know, motherfuckers acting like that.
Right.
But, and then she walked off, and as soon as she got in the terminal, these dudes in fucking overcoat, trench coats, just fucking walkie-talkies converged. They were like, shh, we have her. Where is he? And I'm shooting down stairs or an escalator in the middle of this family. Like, they're like, who the fuck are you? And I'm like, just.
You don't want to know.
Like, you know, and I merged in with this family, the mother, father, and their kids.
You do have a childlike quality to you, even though you're a madman.
Yes,
right?
I've
like,
been
oh,
told
that's,
that.
That's Johnny.
So here's how I got away. because never in a million years did they think this motherfucker's gonna go get the luggage on the carousel. But I had an ounce of coke, and I was such a cokehead that I fucking went over and hid behind the column, and this kid was over there wearing an Anthrax shirt, and we had just played with Anthrax at the Beacon, and I'm like, psst, psst, and he's fucking got headphones with Walkman on, and then I just took a quarter and just binged him in the head with it. He's like, yo, what the f- John Joseph from the Cro-Mags, holy. I said, yo, yo. I said, the cops are after me. Take this ticket and go get my luggage. So he gets my fucking luggage.
Wait, we gotta get that guy on the podcast, because that's the greatest story of all time.
And the thing was, I said to her, listen, if I get away, call me at the Alcatraz bar later. That was the hang. That was the coke spot. And so the kid gets my bag. And as I'm getting it, I run outside to get in a cab. They obviously went out to the street side first to look for me. And then we're like, where the fuck is he? He got away. Then they went back in the terminal. It was like, you know, like some fucking Laurel and Hardy shit.
I don't get away with anything. You've gotten away with,
hey man,
more
I had the higher power looking out for my dumb ass.
All right, John, I don't know how the hell to shut you up, because your life's too fascinating, man.
But I got away. And I went to the bar.
Then he went on a wheatgrass bender for 8 days straight.
No, but
nothing but wheatgrass.
Yeah. But the phone rings in the bar. And they're like, it's for you. And I thought it was her. I was like, hey, Kate. And he's like, it's not Kate. It's Kate's father. And the first words out of his mouth were, you're good, John. You're very good. We had a team of detectives and off-duty FBI agents trying to catch you.
Jeez.
In L.A. And how you got off that fucking plane, I have no idea. But here's the deal. Stay away from my daughter. All this goes away. Otherwise, you're going to fucking federal prison. And I go, but I love her, man. And it was like, click.
Good.
That was it. Go to a crack house. Burnt out building. To freebase the coke.
Mm-hmm.
Dude smashes me over the fucking head. They rob me.
Ugh.
I'm in Tompkins Square Park. Gash in the head. Pouring fucking rain. Everything gone. Everything. No money. No drugs. No friends. Rock bottom. Crying. Sitting in the pouring rain. And I went to the Hare Krishna temple. I said, if you don't let me stay here, I'm going to be dead. And then I climbed myself. They let me stay. And I climbed out of hell from there.
Jesus.
That's, you know.
My God.
Anyway.
Good God.
Ain't been sober since. Got back into training. All the stuff.
Wow. I need rehab after that. Holy
yeah,
cow.
Right?
That's, you know, emotional whirlwind.
It's like a flashback. I'm feeling all the
My God.
Cocaine in my butt, in Jeez. My bone marrow.
Oh, my God. That's, man, your life's insane. All right, yeah. On part 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we get up to the current speed. John, I mean, what else can I say? You have led a fascinating life, and you disdain moderation, and I love that about you.
Yeah. Moderation is the coward's path. That was my friend who's a Navy SEAL told me that.
No kidding.
Yeah, I got some good friends now, like, that's, you know... It's no bullshit. It's like, yo, you know, I failed in one race. That I only, every Ironman I've ever competed in, and it's like 10 now, yeah. Only one did I not finish, and it's because I was unprepared. It was freezing in Florida, like whatever, but he just let me have the sauce.
Yeah.
And I just wrote his quote in my new book on PMA, because the letter he wrote me of why I failed. And he said, dude, it's all about the PMA, because he used to work with the Cro-Mags and was like a punk rock dude,
yeah.
Black dude, Trinidad. He was in the movie Act of Valor. He was the Trinidadian TIE fighter dude. And, you know, it's just, and I've had so many great people. Rich Roll is a huge mentor for me now, that I just look up to these people. And, like, you know, my guru, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he always said, example's better than precept. In other words, nobody's looking for what you say, because everybody runs their mouth in this day and age, social media and everything else. It's the example that you set. It's how you live your life day to day, how you treat people when the cameras are turned off. I know a lot of people that are so fucking phony, and I won't mention their names. When you see them on TV, they act so genuine and yoga and this and that, and then they're complete pricks to people mm-hmm. when there's no cameras turned on. So I look to what people do as a, it's not what somebody says, it's how they treat people, how they act, the example that they lead. And I've been blessed to be around a lot of and develop great friendships with like Rich Roll and his wife, Julie, and Brendan Braziers of the world, and the guys that made Forks Over Knives, and just the athlete community and Iron Man is tremendous. Jimmy Brady, FDNY, he was just hurt. I have to give him a shout out because I don't know if you saw in the news that facade that was burning and fell.
Yep.
My friend was the one who was running up. They thought a kid was on the third floor, Jimmy Brady, and ran in that freaking building with them other guys to save those kids' lives and the whole facade.
Jeez,
and he cracked like three vertebrae. I mean, it's like these are fucking heroes and people, you know, wearing the uniform and going, you know, doing what they got to do and just keeping the PMA, man, no matter what. So I've been blessed to be around a lot of amazing people, and they give you the straight sauce.
Yeah.
You know, there's times they've told, and my girlfriend too, like, you know, she's got two black belts.
I've seen her on your Instagram lives.
She's got two black belts. Mm-hmm. She's a Buddhist, and it's like, she doesn't get let me get away with nothing.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck you. I don't care if you're John from the Cro-Mags, whoever the fuck. This is bullshit. And, you know, and you need that. No matter who the fuck you are, there's a check and balance system in this world.
Yeah.
There needs to be some authority over your life on how to act and how to do things. And, you know, that's the problem. Everybody just thinks they could do whatever they want and insult people. And it's the society has kind of become that to a certain degree. Like, you know, I can say whatever I want and it don't matter, or do or treat people badly. And I've just... You know, there's a saying in Beng, Chinara Pisune China, Taro Ivashi Hishnuna, Manida Manandida, Kitani Yasadahari, that you should think of yourself lower than the straw in the street, more tolerant than a tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige. In that state of mind, in that state of consciousness, you can constantly chant and meditate the holy names of Krishna or God or whatever path you're on. So I try to, you know, adhere to that philosophy and be at the service call of others. That's what keeps me in line these days, where I don't have any downtime.
Word. John, thank you, man.
Hey, man. You know, but I got another, can I say the other title of my other book?
Yeah.
I caught a lot of slack from.
Oh, yeah.
It's called, I wrote a comedy book, because truth be told, I had dudes telling, I've been plant-based since 81, not eating
way
meat.
Way before.
Yeah, before it was fucking trendy. And so I was in the gym when we were trying to come up with a title for my book on plant-based nutrition and putting the information out there. And I was going to call it the Grow... I was going to call it the Go Green Road to Health, Fitness, and Longevity. And my business partner, Todd Irwin, who I love, goes, dude, who the fuck are you, Dr. Oz? He goes, nobody wants to hear that book title from John Bloodclot. You need to come up with a real title.
Right.
So this dude in the gym that my friend was training for a fight, and I was telling him about eating plant-based and vegan, and he's like, oh, man, all them fucking vegans are pussies. Don't tell him that. I said, what? Motherfucker, put on some headgear. Let's go. And he's like, what? And I was like, yo, I haven't eaten meat since blah, 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 blah. And then I told Todd that later, and Todd was the one. He was like, dude, that's it. You got to throw it back in their face. They're saying vegans and vegetarians are pussies. Fuck that. You have to throw it back in their face. Yeah. Meat is for pussies. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And it's funny because, listen, a woman, Karen Rinaldi, who's with HarperCollins that put the book.
Yeah.
She's like, you have to be disruptive. A woman was the one who was like,
embrace that
we
title.
You need to stick with this title, because I was like, should I tell her? Yeah, so that book came out. I got a YouTube channel of cooking called The Hard Truth with John Joseph.
Yeah.
And I just, And you know, there's no ads, there's no fucking commercials, there's no nothing. I'm just, I pay the producer to do the segment, and I try to cook good recipes and be, you know, have a sense of humor. You don't have to have a stick up your ass, which a lot of vegans do, and that's what turned people off.
It can be off-putting, right. Yeah.
You know, Joe Rogan smashes vegans a lot, and I understand why. Because back in the day, a lot of them were judgmental pricks that were like, I'm better than you because I don't eat animals. But my whole thing is you need to have compassion for everybody and have a sense of humor about it, man. Fucking, you know, and that book has converted everybody from ex-cons to truck drivers to special forces dudes to MMA fighters on fucking down.
Yeah.
Because it's like, dude.
Your social media is very effective with that too. It's
the
like,
vernacular that you speak, that's how I nobody ever put it in that way for me, man. And now I'm like, yo.
Right.
Thank God it's someone who's, I was like, man, I'm one of you, dude. I just happen to abstain from meat and dairy and fish and, you know, now the evidence has come out that the plant-based diet is the way to go. Forks over knives, what the hell? The plant-based diet saves the environment. Right. It saves animals, you know.
Right.
It's
unsustainable, yeah.
Say that in a lot of interviews, too. I come from a world of violence and death and murders in front of me and everything else. It's like the last thing I want to do is contribute to the violence caused towards any... I try to roll with the ahimsa, which is, you know... Be nonviolent, you know, only use, be prepared in case you have to throw down, but why cause suffering to harmless, innocent creatures, man, you know? So that's, you know, what it comes down to and still playing music and all the other shit, you know? And I get to hang out with super cool. Yo, I gotta give you, I gotta give you props because I've hung out with you. And I'm like, they're like, what's that? I'm like, that dude's a funny motherfucker, man. Like, and people, if you saw when I posted that up, people were like, yeah, man, I watch him on the news. He's a fucking jokester. I was like, yeah, Steve Lacy got jokes.
Word, man. I appreciate that. That's a thrill for me to hear you say that. I really appreciate
that. No, I mean that. I don't blow smoke up nobody's ass. That's not, I'm not that guy. If I didn't think it, I wouldn't say it, you know, so. And anyway, but thanks for having me up here.
Our pleasure, man.
Running 10 miles in Central Park.
Yeah.
So that's my next thing.
All right, man.
Cool.
I can't believe you have 10 miles in you after telling all those stories.
Oh, yeah. I saved energy for the run.
All right, John. Thanks,
man. Thank you, brother.
Are you still there with me, everybody? All right. That was incredible, wasn't it? John Joseph. I promise you, I've had the chance to hang out with him once, just in real life, too. He's just always like this. So on. He's got so many stories to tell. Such a fascinating dude. So smart. So cool. And the great thing is, I referenced it at the beginning, but John is one of the segments of my new upcoming When New York Rock special, which is going to air on Fox 5 on July 5th. That's a Thursday, I believe. July 5th, anyway. But so we took the walking tour with him, Lower East Side. It's so great. The stories that we didn't even touch on in the podcast. I also do a thing on L'Amour, the famous departed metal club in Brooklyn. And I talk to Michael Alago, the famous record exec who signed Metallica, among others. So it's a great special. I'm really proud of it. John's a big part of it. If you liked this conversation, you'll love the special. That's going to be, again, on Fox 5. The week of July 4th, I believe the special actually airs July 5th. Make sure you check that out. Our website, Fox5NY, for the details on the air date. But check it out. Thanks for being with us on Binge Talking. All right, I'm going to go be vegan for 2 days now. Peace. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. This episode was recorded, edited, and mixed by Matt Onimus. Our executive producers are me, Matt, and Ahmad Asghar. Our vice president of news is Byron Harmon, and our vice president and general manager is Lou Leone. Binge Talking is part of the Fox 5 Podcast Network. I'm Steve Lacy, and if you have any questions or comments, feel free to hit me up on Twitter, at Stephen Lacy with a V, or on Instagram, Steve Lacy, STEVELACY. In the meantime, stay tuned for our next episode.